Hi, welcome to Outrageous, a bi-weekly podcast where we talk about race, culture, politics, media, and everything in between. My name is Chris. I'm in New York City, and yet again, I'm joined by my two very best friends, Trisha in LA.
Hello.
And Jason in DC.
Hey there.
Hey guys, what's up?
How's it going? Oh,
feeling really good. You're really blessed that I've turned off my air conditioning so that I can talk to you because it is hot.
The whole audience here. Thanks you. The whole audience thanks you. On behalf of the Outrageous community,
we have a significant number of podcasts that start with Trisha saying, "You guys are really lucky that I... You guys are really blessed that I chose, that I deign to be here." You have no idea how your life has been enriched by
you
me
really
podcasting
don't.
With... Oh, Jesus.
Okay, you really don't.
You're standing by? You're doubling down?
No. No, but you know what? Like, we've had the air conditioning running, like, continuously, which we're about to start experiencing summer air conditioning bills, but it's been really blazing hot. And we're in the valley, so it's like always 10 degrees hotter than everywhere else in California.
Which
means I'm laying around all day doing nothing. That's really what I mean.
I have a choice to make.
What?
So my bedroom is the fire escape is in my bedroom, my window.
Yeah.
And there have been some robberies in this neighborhood, and the police said that they've been using fire escapes to get in. I usually keep my window locked. But the thing is, I don't have an air conditioner in my room, and I really want to put one in there. So now I have to decide either I take the risk and put an air conditioner in the window, making it easier for someone to come in, or I just survive without it. And I'm really 50-50. I don't know. These are aircon problems, everyone.
So is it just robbery or is it robbery murder? That might depend on that. Might
wow. Wow.
If they're just gonna take your shit, then just
exactly.
Put in the air conditioner.
Then you risk it.
I'll lazily look and be like, take whatever you want, just leave the air conditioning. Oh.
It may be the end of the podcast because we won't have the technology to do
it. I know, but let them take it.
Sorry, everyone. We are no longer posting Outrageous because Chris put an air conditioner.
You would be posting it with the robber. Whatever.
Hey, I'm just saying.
I'm in New York City, joined by Chris's two very best friends. You know.
Listen, I'm being very realistic here. I'm being really realistic because I watch a lot of the ID channel, and so these are questions. Okay. Is it just robbery?
Jason, quick story about Trisha, like she's not here. Her and her sister love the ID channel. Do you know what this is?
No, I do not.
It's a channel where every show is about women getting raped, brutalized, murdered, or victimized in some way. So
that's wonderful.
All these broads are watching for like hours. So her and her sister they fully expect, right, that there's like on any given day, there's like a good 65-80% chance they will be brutally murdered. And it's messing with your mind. And you guys should just stop watching. I always tell you, stop watching that damn show, like that channel.
You know what? It's
nothing I said was false. Right? So you don't even have a rebuttal. You just have to admit you have a problem.
No, you know, it's completely fair. And I actually had a conversation with B yesterday because I said, you're actually being changed by this show now. You are. You know, you thought, because for a long time I was thinking to myself, is she remaining unchanged? Because sometimes I will check out. I'll be like, okay, these are too much. I'll check out and I'll check back in every now. But she used to watch them forever. And I'm like, are you sure you're not being changed by it? I find it hard to believe that something that you're taking in isn't having an impact on you.
When she installed the panic room, that was probably like your first. You walked in and saw like the steel reinforced doors, and you were like, "Wait a minute!"
And then there were three pit bulls in the
yard. Yeah, right. She pointed a loaded gun at your head when you walked in one day, and you're like, "Hold on a second! Have you been watching too much ID channel? What's happening?"
But you know the one really good news about that is that because we watch a channel, we realize that they actually end up mining the same crimes for different format shows. So it's not like it's actually happening that much, because clearly it's not happening enough that they are getting new crime stories. They're always mining like the same 50 or 60 that they repackage over and over again.
Well, it's always the same. It's like cheating husbands, cheating husband who has an insurance policy on his wife, cheating husband who is also a drunk and domestic violence.
Well, but I mean, like, the themes might be the same, but it's actually the exact same cases. So that gives me hope. That's what I mean. Like, there's still
saying, talking about the same 50 crimes. Like,
exactly the same actual 50 crimes repackaged. So then it's like one of them is like a husband, so they're focusing on the husband side of it. And then the next one is like, wait, but he was a brother as well. Let's do brothers who.
They talk to his father. They talk to the paper boy. They talk to the bad clerk. All right, let's jump into it. Jason, tell us about stuff.
I'm really struggling with this, and it has to do with immigration. I've never been a real hawk when it comes to immigration, because I'm always like, you know, borders, what is that? People should go, you know, people should be able to go where they want to go. What's the big deal? But, you know, the reality we have in this country, and I want to say this carefully, because I'm not blaming people who've migrated here illegally. I'm not pointing fingers, but just it seems to me the facts are that we as a society enjoy low prices on a lot of things, largely because not everything, but those things are produced with illegal labor, with employers paying people who are in the country illegally, illegally low amounts of money. And I think that actually this is a big problem, because it seems to me that it has led to the stagnation of wages. I'm not saying it's the only thing, but it seems to be a significant factor of why wages don't go up, because for a lot of employers, their constant incentive, you know, they want to maximize profits, which means minimizing labor costs and minimizing prices, or you know, getting that sweet spot of where, how much, you know, the most that someone will spend. And we're in this position where we the consumers in this country, we have this conflict of interest within ourselves, where we want low prices, we may need low prices, but in order to get those low prices, it requires illegal, you know, labor, which then means we have trouble getting jobs that pay anything. So I'm wondering, like, what the answer is. I mean, I certainly don't think the answer is, you know, obviously rounding up 12 million people and taking them out of the country. I'm sensitive to the fact that even right now, we're seeing another massive influx of people from Central America crossing the border illegally. I think it's clear that the evidence is clear that building a wall is not the answer, would not work, is not a good use of resources, et cetera. But I don't know, like, I'm really worried about, and get back to something we've talked about repeatedly, which is like, what's the path to wages rising again? This seems to be a big impediment. And I'd love to hear from you two whether you have ideas or thoughts about, you know, how do we get a handle on the role that illegal immigration and illegally paying people too little, that those two things are playing in the wage stagnation reality?
Like so many of the discussions that we have, they are about economics. I guess that's the fifth thing that we should say in the opener that we're always talking about. Unlike some of the other things, like economics is like follows laws and rules, most of which the three of us are not totally versed in. And maybe this is my naivete, but people are coming over the border because there is work here for them to do. And people will pay them for that work, as you said, Jason. They'll pay them illegally because they're here illegally. I'm not a Trump supporter. I don't think I could ever be mistaken for one. But on some level, if he rounded up 12 million people and sent them back to their countries and then had a system in place by which the jobs that they are vacating could pay a living wage to Americans, then that might actually begin to fix a problem. However, it's the second step that will never happen, because there will always be illegal people coming here and they will always work for less. And if there's anything that Americans know, it's that free labor or cheap labor, it's the way to build everything. You know what I mean? So I'm not certain what we can do other than overhaul. I say this every week. We'd have to overhaul the way that we think about capitalism. We need people who will work for next to nothing to produce all the really great shit that we all own.
Trisha. Okay. Trisha?
Well, in this country, we work off incentives, right? Incentives.
In every country. Breaks. Money. We work for money. That is an incentive.
Well, no, I mean, but tax breaks, popularity points, citizenship points, I don't know.
Yeah, but who are you talking about? Like, yes, that's true, but who are you talking about?
I'm not talking about the immigrant. Because, okay. Listen, I mean, in some ways, well, first and foremost, people are not fleeing South and Central American countries just because of labor.
Right.
So this is also tied to American foreign policy. So it's intricately tied to our destabilization of those regions as well, right? And for whatever political gain or power grab that affords us. So it's not simply sort of raw economics, right? I mean, we have a kind of political will to go into regions of the world and establish bases there for ill gain. And the side effect is that those regions are then destabilized, forcing people to leave them and come to us. And then our punishment is that we now have cheap labor in America. So I feel like that problem can be impacted on in many ways, right? Either we are going to have a sort of general foreign policy shift, a sort of isolationist policy, mind you, and that could sort of stem the tide.
And by isolationist, just to put a finer point on this, you're talking about we're no longer intervening in the policy matters in other countries.
It's
not just isolationist that we don't want you to come here. You're saying, yep, the step before that is that we should stop meddling.
Meddling for our own ends, which then ends up biting sort of American citizenry in its ass when they try to establish these bizarre anti-immigration or anti-refugee or anti-whatever stances without actually asking themselves, how did we get here? So, Jason, that's the first thing that comes to my mind when I think about your issue about sort of like paying people lower wages and all of those kinds of questions, right? It's like we have established a sort of foreign policy universe where this is the end result of the destabilization of other regions. But I feel like Americans don't actually ask themselves that question. They don't ask themselves why people come here. They're just upset that people are here.
What you're raising,
and that's a part that they have control, right? You have some control there.
What you're raising, though, positions America as the progenitor of all.
Not all. Not all, but some, well, a participant.
I won't disagree with you. But even without America's interference, America's legendary interference, it could stand to reason some of these countries would become destabilized on their own. Whether they can, maybe it's countries having trouble with other countries, like Iraq versus Iran, or other things that have something to do with us, but largely have to do with cultural, religious, and historical reasons that don't put us at the center of that conflict. So given that will
those ignore, immigrants,
and but those see, immigrants those, are going to come here, then how do we deal with them?
But see, when those immigrants come here, they're not the cheap labor, if you think about it. Those, I mean, when we think about cheap labor now, we're really overwhelmingly thinking about brown people. We don't have a problem.
We're talking about brown people who live in Central and South America because they can conceivably get here without being on a plane.
Exactly.
Or some transatlantic, transpacific boat, which is important.
Exactly. It's an important point. But what I'm saying is that we have a relationship with this region that is much more... it's much more obvious than sort of the cultural and like historical issues that's happening in sort of European countries. I don't want to necessarily get trapped in that. But what I'm trying to say is that illegal low paid immigrants is just kind of, it's a small part of a bigger pie, and I feel like tackling that is only symptomatic. It's only tackling a symptom. It's not going to tackle
the
fact that multinational corporations want cheap labor.
I'm building a straw man because I know you're not saying this, but react to this. So are you saying that the only way to fix the immigrant problem as it stands currently is that we have to think on a more global macro level?
Always. I think we do. I mean, we have to see things in movement, in relation to each other, right? Because why do we have low paid wage? Why are we willing to pay people low wages? Because ultimately people want we've built a consumption society, and the only way that people are able to consume much is if we make it very cheap for them to consume. Well, how are we going to make it cheap for people to consume? By having increasingly cheap labor.
But maybe my question was too facile. Like maybe, or maybe actually no, maybe not though. But Tricia, don't you see like in constantly going back to global constructions and global solutions, we're tying our hands for boots on the ground. So what we're saying is that until America can adopt an isolationist policy, that immigration is just going to be a problem. And if that's what you're saying, that's fine. I don't know if I agree or disagree with that, but I do recognize that constructing it that way means there's nothing we can do until there's a massive cultural and economic shift worldwide.
Well, it doesn't have to be worldwide. I mean, I don't want to – I mean, all we have to do is look at what's happening in Europe, right? Because their borders are as porous as what ours are for South and Central Americans. And look at what happened there. They're about to be overwhelmed by a lot of cheap labor that we call refugees.
So what I find interesting, and part of why I asked the question, is that there's so little talk in this country about cracking down on employers. And I don't know whether that would be the answer or whether that would significantly positively impact the problem. I don't know. But it surprises me that neither, you know, the Republicans tend to focus on we got to get these people out of here and stop them from coming in. Democrats tend to be, you know, we need a path to citizenship. No one talks about we've got all these employers that are actually doing this and they should be in jail.
Well, see, that's why I initially raised the question of incentives, Jason, and tax breaks, because what I'm saying is that you do have the ability to track down employers. You know, you do know the industries that are creating cheap labor, and there's a single person that's responsible, as opposed to sort of like trying to figure out the 50 or 60 immigrant in a region. You can go to one construction company and deal with that one owner.
Yeah, but then it would be like, oh, the government's coming down on this job creator.
I do think that's the problem. That's why we're not doing it.
Yeah. And so that's why when I say it's a global issue, I don't just necessarily mean a worldwide issue in that way. I mean it in a sort of the way that we conceptualize our relationship to citizens and our relationships to the structures in the country. So I want it to be a structural conversation, not a conversation about Juan crossing the border. I want to talk about what's the multinational corporation that has a hand in destabilizing Juan's country for some sort of pipeline or whatever it is that then comes back at the American citizen who then wants to get Juan's job, supposedly.
Okay.
Like, that's how it gets characterized, right?
I want to back all the way up, actually. Because you know what, Trisha? You said something that sparked me in thinking about what is really the problem here, right?
Yep.
But let's select a problem to talk about. Because as you say it, let's say I'm part of, you know, HyperChris Global Communications Corporation, and I destabilize El Salvador, and I know that's going to cause a flood of people over the border into America, into Texas, and Arizona, where I have my factories built up and I need cheap labor. So it's all part of like a single plan. Now that's very nefarious and diabolical, I agree. But let's select the problem. Jason said like immigration's the problem. From where corporations stand and even local businesses, small businesses, maybe it's not. So what
it
exactly
isn't.
Are we talking
and that's
about?
Why there's been well, no But see, that's what I'm saying. There's no way to stem it when it's not a problem for the people who actually generate the problem. It's only
Jason,
a problem for the American citizen.
But Jason, I'm going to throw this back to you then, right? So you hear what we're saying. Then what is the problem? Because immigration itself isn't really a problem because it helps our country in myriad ways. You know, like, our country was built on the backs of people who earn nothing or very, very little. Like, that's the American way. So in some way, it's not... The fact that people are coming here and working cheaply isn't a problem for America. Where is the problem?
To me, the problem is low wages. That's the problem.
For who?
For the vast majority of Americans. Let me say it differently. Okay, thank you for pushing. The vast majority of people living in the United States of America, we have access to jobs that offer only very low wages. That's the problem.
So it maybe that's not an immigration issue.
Maybe that's the question to debate. I mean, I think that businesses hiring people who are in the country illegally and therefore cannot demand or seek recourse for making less than minimum wage the fact that there are companies willing to hire those folks and pay them illegally low wages, and there's no penalty that's enforced, seems to me to be one of several drivers of keeping wages low. So I guess the question, the first question is, do you agree with me that that's one of the factors? And then the second question, which I think was what we've been talking about, is what could we possibly do about that? And maybe there's no answer. We can go to the next topic.
No, it feels
so big. It's really hard to get my arms around it.
No, it is big, and to further complicate it, let me just say, as you were saying, Tricia, about destabilizing, I mean, there's certainly plenty of truth about our foreign policy, and we've done things to destabilize countries. I think, though, and I'm not an expert on this, but I think that the bigger driver at this moment of the folks fleeing from Central America is less political foreign policy and more the fact that we people in this country have a strong appetite for illegal drugs
and illegal guns. Which is connected. I mean, it's not always political what our actions are, right? Because we've seen that people, if you scratch the surface far enough and you look at where the guns are coming from, it's a really dodgy conversation. Right. So I do think that, I mean, and then those folks are fleeing from violence, right? And then you're wondering, what about the drug trade and what about the gun trade, and all of those things are sort of related. To me, I feel like immigration is like, you know, you start at A for the problem, and immigration to me feels like F. Like I feel like it's the end of something. And then the American people respond because at that moment they become aware of something having a personal impact on them. But I feel like there's a through line that ends with immigration, but doesn't begin with immigration.
I think that's well said. I totally agree with that.
Me too.
And so immigration is like symptomatic that the American public can respond to, right?
But hashtag whenever Team Tricia.
I'm just trying to figure out. Like, what I'm trying to figure out though is how, because the only part in our current process, right, the only way that we can have an impact is by engaging the American citizenry to vote or to do things differently. And so I feel like we can't start with immigration. We might have to back into the problem so that the American citizen understands where this is coming from and where they have the ability to make different choices. Because that's the only way for us to feel like we have some control, right? That's the only way for us to have a lever in the system. Because otherwise, you end up with build a wall.
That shouldn't even enter the conversation.
Right.
Agreed. Yeah.
Agreed.
It feels like a weird solution. So then I want to back up and go, okay, are we talking about responsibilities for companies, which I liked that you were starting to ask, Chris. And Jason, I think that's really the recourse. I think that's where we have real recourse, is that, I mean, nowadays we punish companies for different things. We're like, we're not going to buy your product because you do A, B, C, and D. I mean, why can't we have that, the use of like cheap labor as a potential lever?
I'll tell you why. It's really who rallies around that. Because on one side you have liberals, the other side conservatives. We go after companies for things like, man, you have a bad LGBT policy. Man, 87% of your board is men. And the idea is that we want everyone at the table. So when you want to punish a company for giving jobs to people who are here illegally, like, liberals can't get behind that because the liberal mindset
sounds funky.
Yeah, it's slightly anti-corp anyway. And the idea that these corporations are actually paying money to brown people, to illegal immigrants, giving them a chance in some way, you know, we want to laud that.
Right.
And conservatives don't want to come out against it because, hello, the conservatives are the ones hiring all the illegal immigrants at their plants, et cetera.
There are plenty of liberals doing that too.
That's the point. The money people who could actually get the groundswell to do it, no one is incentivized to come after those companies.
No, that's well said. I think you're right. I mean, as you say that, it leads me to think that the thing is, people in power both from an economic standpoint and a political standpoint, are benefiting from the current system. I think my argument is, and I think you're right, Tricia, that it's F, it's not A, it's not the primary driver, but the majority of the population is this the fact that we allow this to happen hurts them, but that majority tends to be the more disenfranchised people. Because even like the three of us, like illegal immigration or companies hiring and paying illegally doesn't affect us, right? Like people who are, have, you know, advanced degrees, and like it's people, you know, it's working class, and they're also the least powerful people. So I think I'm just like talking through why you're right, Chris, that like the incentives for those who are in a position to do anything about it, they don't have the incentives to do anything about it. And those who have the incentives to do something about it are not in a position to do anything about it.
And this is why Trump has to hit the drums like they're rapists. They're really doing drugs because that's going to affect the common person. The real problem that illegal immigrants present only affect, ironically enough, the people who'd vote against them. I mean, not ironically, I guess that makes sense, right? It's the working class people on the border states, the mostly Republican states, like they're feeling it for real.
But it affects everyone, right? It affects everyone in terms of it trickling up in some way. But the real challenge... Exactly. The problems trickle up. It doesn't trickle down.
I love how Ronald Reagan has forever ruined the word trickle.
I know, trickle.
We have to refuel for the word.
I know. It's such
Nothing
a
trickles.
Nothing trickles. Whenever anyone says trickles, you're like, you raise an eyebrow. It's like when you say you people. You ever say, oh, you people over there, come over here. You people? It's like you know what I meant.
Well, you know my favorite thing. It's just like how Germany has ruined the word Roundup.
I know. The Germans should never have done that rounding up. No one can round up anything anywhere now. Thanks
I know.
Germans.
Only
for that. Also for the other thing you did. That was terrible.
Yeah. That's different, though. Trickle is a natural phenomenon. Round up, I feel like when talking about people rounding up other people, don't just blame the Germans. That's a bad idea no matter who's doing it.
I tried to reclaim the word round up by saying let's round these kids up and give them cookies, but it
it's still...
Honey,
it's still
once you start your sentence, you're like, let's round up all children. Eyebrows get arched.
And not just because of the Germans. It's not just the Germans.
No, I know.
Wow, tangent. Anyway.
To return to Jason's initial question.
I love semantics. That was fun. I barely care about my topic now. Let's talk about more words we can't use anymore.
Honestly, Jason, your topic is super complicated, and it's got 100 different tentacles. It's really hard to even get people on the same page to identify what the problem is. Bloods are people... They're putting stress on our structures. I know that's true vaguely, but I would actually want to see the numbers about it. Are immigrants making more emergency room visits than others? I'm sure that probably is true because they don't have insurance, but is that causing like an undue
weight on the system,
burden on communities? I don't know.
Well, I don't think so. I mean, that's why that's not what I brought up.
I know you're not bringing it up. My point is that like we have to find what the problem is. Your question is like, what do we do about the problem? And my rebuttal to you is, I'm not certain which problem we're talking about. Illegal immigration is not a problem.
I said low wages. I keep saying it. That's
the problem. But even then, I have questions. Low wages for who and under what conditions and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You're saying, and I know you answered low wages for Americans. I get that. But then even I find that complicated.
Well, no, I changed that. Low wages for everyone in this country, including people here legally and illegally.
Okay.
But I think you're right. You're right. It's complicated. This conversation has been very helpful to me. It really has pushed my thinking. What I'd like to see is a platform that, you know, someone runs on, whether it's for president or whatever, but like that, like we're going to hold companies accountable for hiring, you know, illegal labor and paying people illegally low wages, whether they be here legal or not.
And I think the only way you can do that is if you succeed in taking money out of politics.
Or if you have a benevolent billionaire.
I don't know if those go together.
Either what Tricia said or the exact opposite of what Tricia said. Let's move on to a different topic. Let's leave illegal immigration there. And Tricia, let's just jump into what you're doing.
Well, I mean, I think this is actually a pretty good segue, because I think that my question is sort of rooted in, are we asking the right questions, or are we looking at the problem in the right way? So I read a piece several weeks ago that has sort of resonated with me on some level, and I wanted to talk about it. So Pat Buchanan.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yes, right? It's like, who is Pat Buchanan? Where has he been? Why
am
I
sorely? Oh, I miss him so much.
Why am I even talking about Pat Buchanan at all? But I think Pat Buchanan on his own platform several weeks ago wrote a piece called The Great White Hope. And essentially, I think his contention in the piece, or I think what he attempted to do, was sort of explain the rise of Trump and why Trump's message is resonating with his voters. And I'm going to say his voters right now. We can probably unpack who his voters are. You know, we've been having this ongoing dialogue on our podcast about Trump and like his rise and what it means. And what I liked about the piece was that it attempted to just be, I think it was like brutally honest about what Trump means to his voters. And that's why I wanted to talk about it, because I feel like we sort of ruffle our, everybody's feathers are ruffled and they wander around and they circle around about Trump, and they never really confront why it is that Trump's message is resonating with his audience. You know, they sort of talk about the media's participation in Trump and blah, 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 blah. But what I wanted to know was, again, what is Trump saying that's really getting to the heart of what's going on? And so Pat Buchanan attempts to unpack that in his piece called The Great White Hope. So anyway, so what I wanted to ask you all about the piece was, do you think that Pat Buchanan has nailed why Trump's message, whatever that message is resonating with his audience? Where will Trump's message go? What impact will his message have if he doesn't secure the presidency? What space did it create for somebody else, if that at all?
I am surprised that this is your question, honestly.
Why? What surprises you about it? What question did you think you wanted to ask about it?
Well,
because that's a response too.
Having read it, the first part of your question about, you know, what is it that Trump's doing that's resonating? I feel like that's been answered. That is no longer a mystery to me. I think living here in this country, the history of our country, just the fact that he was able to gin up a base doesn't actually surprise me. Those people have always been there. What surprised me, what I want to say about the article was that I was surprised by how ineffective it was, honestly. Pat Buchanan starts the article by talking about how a curious thing is happening to white men in America, and that they're dropping dead, that they're dying more, that their suicide rates are going up. And then he bemoans slash laments a past where it used to be that white men were shown on TV as doctors and lawyers, but now they're the subjects of discrimination and it's perfectly okay to bash them, et cetera, et cetera. The thing that I found really interesting about reading this post-Trump is, as I mentioned, how ineffective it is. This kind of dog whistling no longer works for the American public when you have someone like orange-faced and screaming about how he wants to build a wall and about how, you know, women are fat and ugly, and it just doesn't work anymore. In the article, Buchanan doesn't actually select a problem, right?
He
describes this world where, oh, white men are suffering and et cetera, but unlike Trump, he doesn't say, like, and we need black people off TV. They can't be scientists or lawyers the way that white men, you know, he doesn't say any of that. You know, while Trump is saying, let's build a wall, let's deport all Muslims, Buchanan stops short of saying that. And in that way, it read to me like something you'd see from the old pre-Trump Republican Party. I didn't find Buchanan persuasive. It sounded like the same kind of bullshit the Republicans are always throwing out there, nink, like, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, like, oh, white people are better, right? What world does Pat Buchanan inhabit where white people are not on TV? Because I want to go to that world. What world does he inhabit where white people are no longer the scientists, the lawyers, the doctors, the action-adventure stars? Like, I would say with just, I would say that over 92% of all of those roles on TV are filled by white people. So, and it's not the factual nature, the lack of facts in the article. It's just that he needed more invective, and Trump is full of invective. And to loop around, Tricia, that's why he's successful with the American public. Invective sells. We talked about this previously. It's rhetoric, and it plays.
Well, so I thought the article, it started out with some data about, you know, the fact that white men are dying prematurely at really high rates compared to anybody else right now. And that, you know, I've heard that data elsewhere. That was from a recent study. And the article actually started out just kind of talking about that data, and it made some fair points. And then I agree that it just got it got into this, like, reality that doesn't exist. I mean, I have yet to see any piece of evidence whatsoever that white men are discriminated against, which he specifically makes that claim, doesn't back that up with any data. I think that's just false. And I agree with you, Chris, that all the things he said, like, that white men used to be seen doing, white men are still seen doing.
He complains that, you know, well, white men used to be presidents. Well, an overwhelming, over 99% of the presidents right. have been white. Like, the fact, but this is the thing. That's the difference between him and Donald Trump. Donald Trump will say Barack Obama is a terrible president, right? He's horrible for these reasons. You know, but Buchanan stopped short of saying that.
Well,
and it
but
makes
it
ineffective.
No, but I mean, I don't think that was the point of the piece. The piece seemed to be, you know, why is it resonating? It, you know, why is Trump resonating? He's resonating because white males are despondent because of the way the world has changed against them. I mean, that was the point. I don't agree with you that there was some inadequacy from that standpoint in the piece. So one thing I found really interesting a couple weeks ago on Bill Maher, Scott Adams, who's the guy who does Dilbert, the comic strip, was on and was talking about, he's an expert apparently in persuasion, and was saying that
a weirdo. Look him up, everybody. But anyway, go ahead.
Well, it's just, so I don't know, I've never studied this field of persuasion, but he was talking, he said that when Trump first announced his candidacy, Trump used all of these tools of persuasion, and Adam said, I knew right then he was going to win the general election in a landslide. Now, I don't know if he's right, but he gave examples of things that Trump does that are, like, really fundamental tools of persuasion. One of them is the way he brands other people negatively. So the fact that every time he talks about Hillary, he says crooked Hillary. And he says, like, this gets into people's heads. Like, for a lot of people, either people who are already predisposed to not like Hillary or people who didn't have a predisposition, you know, that gets in their head. So then when they hear just Hillary, they're going to think crooked Hillary.
Crooked Hillary.
And he gave examples like that. And he said, you know, his argument was, it was different from what we normally talk about, where it's not even so much. I mean, he is touching on, you know, people's thoughts and prejudices and whatnot, but he's also using these basic tools. So Pat Buchanan's piece, I just don't know if he's quite right. I mean, why are white males dying at such high rates and the overwhelming reasons having to do with suicide and drug abuse? No one knows the answer to that. I mean, there's not been a study done. There are people theorizing about it. Pat Buchanan offered his theory, which was based on some falsehoods. I don't know. But
the fact that white men are apparently declining in power, which is interesting.
But see, this is what I'm saying. So the reason why the article struck me is because I think the very reason that people have, listen, we've always said that Trump skipped entirely past dog whistle and just went directly for the message. Screw the dog, what supposedly you're thinking. Now, having Pat Buchanan come back and sort of tread through Trump's ideas was very useful, because I think that that's an article that even mildly moderate white people can read and feel some resonance with the theme. And that's why I thought the article was compelling. See, you all are sort of focused on the idea that these are not facts, but we know that the American public doesn't deal in facts anymore. It deals in perception. And perception is very powerful and very compelling. And so what I liked about the piece was that it was a perceptual piece. And so even if the numbers don't bear it out, even if it's clear that we've had 99.9% of white presidents, just the presence of Obama and what that meant to people and whether that was a sea change, that's a perceptual shift for people that they're resisting. It's one guy.
Tricia, what I said earlier was it's not about the facts. It's not about the fact that he's peddling lies because, hello, politics, hello, Republicans. It's that I find he didn't go far enough. So it's not enough. What Trump has taught me is that you just throw everything to the wall, balls to the wall, to see what sticks. And the fact that he is
That's
sort
what
of
he
like,
does. That's right.
And just the fact that Buchanan was sort of like, oh, well, lamenting in this way where he was sort of like winking at you like, oh, remember a time when it used to be only white people on TV, et cetera, et cetera. He didn't say that. That's not a statement, but that's what he was trying to get at. But Trump would have just said that. And that's
what I'm saying is, but see, what I'm saying is, listen.
They're both lies, but Buchanan's not going far enough. He could have been more persuasive. That's all I'm saying.
But what I'm saying is you can't, because what I'm saying is you can get Bernie people by saying it the way Buchanan's saying it.
Oh,
because that's what's going
that's
on for
interesting.
Bernie. Too. This is the reason why people can't line up behind Trump is because the message is too strong for certain people. But you can, every single thing that Pat Buchanan situates as a problem is the same problem that Bernie's ilk has situated as a problem too.
Okay, I want to jump in and say, first of all, that's fascinating, right? Because you're positing Buchanan as sort of reaching over to Bernie supporters, being like, come over here.
Because
I think the idea you have of Bernie supporters is really quite negative.
No. I don't have a negative. See, this is what I'm saying. This is why I introduced you in the first place, because I don't have a negative view of Bernie supporters in that way, because I'm pretty clear about what Bernie supporters are resistant to. Everybody's been distracted by the Trump message because it's so brutal, right? It's so in your face. However, what I'm saying is that the sentiments that Trump is really calling to and speaking to is what Pat Buchanan is speaking to, but in a gentler way that can easily resonate with moderates. Because there's real white anxiety there. That's at the seat of some of the things that's happening with Bernie people. There's white anxiety about their place in the world. And so what I was talking about is that I thought that the Pat Buchanan piece was a kind of retreading of that environment in a way that allows for more people to enter the tent, because he's not saying horrible things. He's actually pointing to, guess what? White people are dying. Why are they dying? The landscape is changing. You know, this year we talked about Oscar So White. How did that make you all feel? I mean, what he's really doing is like a seduction and a way to sort of posit and sort of maybe shift a little bit from the sort of craziness of Trump to be able to sort of move beyond Trump if possible. Because those things still exist. All the things that he's talking about, the death of white males, the blah, 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 all those things are true. Those are true things that have been found by the study. If we don't figure out what sort of rationale to give to that, someone else can easily enter the fray. Yes, Trump has entered the fray. And a lot of white people are embarrassed to line up behind Trump, but they don't disagree with the anxiety that Trump is I think, harking to.
I like it.
I hope you're wrong. I don't know, but I hope you're wrong.
Why would I be wrong? Because listen, this was the thing about the piece that was eye-opening to me. What was eye-opening to me was that all the things that I think of as gains for society were fears for others. So for me, when I look at TV and I see that TV is reflective of what the way the world really could possibly be, right? That it's not 98% of white people and blah, 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 blah. You might have Asians in the mix. You're going to have this and this and that. That generates anxiety for some people. We have to talk about what that anxiety will necessarily lead to.
Right. Well,
we don't.
Yeah. I mean, we need to talk about what it could lead to. And
Trump's message can become more palatable, but not crazy.
So you said where it would necessarily lead them. And I don't.
Not necessarily. Well, necessarily only in the sense of history. But, you know, I'm always willing for history to be wrong.
Well, that's why.
But
that's why, I mean, it's you're positing something really interesting. Another thing I saw on Bill Maher, the same episode, I think, was he interviewed. I'm going to bring up Bernie Sanders this time so Chris can get mad at me. But yeah. He interviewed Sanders. And, well, you may know this. So polls right now show that Bernie would beat Trump in the general, but Hillary, it's like even. And mm-hmm. I find that really fascinating. And it almost makes me wonder, like, if Hillary wasn't in the race, I feel like we never ask it that way, but if she wasn't, and it was Bernie versus, you know, Trump, like, I think you're making a great point, Tricia, that Trump's message, if repackaged somewhat like Buchanan perhaps does, could attract more moderate white people. You know, that leads me to think, well, could Sanders' message or a similar message, I mean, my problem with his message is always that this is true of both of them, but I don't see a path to what he's saying. But I don't know. I mean, you're causing me to think about, well, then what is the best response to not go down that path? And it seems like that we should be able to chisel together a platform that is attractive to moderate white people and moderate white people that leads them away from where Trump is going. Because, and I realize I'm being rational when I say this, but I think the direction Trump is going is probably not in the self-interest of even most, you know, working class white people.
What I think is important, and this has been my idea from the start of this election, is that we have been, many of our friends are liberals, I'm liberal, right. Blah, 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 liberal. So we tend to sort of like situate ourselves within the liberal mindset.
Yep.
And we find value in that. What I like to know is what is your worldview? And when I read that piece, I saw a worldview. I didn't agree with it, but I saw a worldview that I find comes up with moderate white people. They do have a belief that they are, that they should be centered, that they don't like the decentering that's happening, you know, with history. I mean, all the claims that Pat Buchanan makes in that piece, you know, it does make everyone uncomfortable. Think about it. You've had a world where you have been the center of that world for a long time. Your stories circulate around you. You know, the history has rationalized you. One of the things I found really compelling, and I'm going to read this because I took a screen cap of it. And I mean, if you thought, if you came across this should be something that you're like, well, yeah, like history shows us that this is what's happening. Listen, he says, children are being taught that America was discovered by genocidal white racists who murdered the native peoples of color, enslaved Africans to do the labor they refused to do, then went out and brutalized and colonized indigenous people all over the world. Those are facts.
Yes, they are.
Right? Those are facts. But I actually saw something pass across my my Twitter feed a couple weeks ago, actually maybe a week or so ago, and somebody said, well, one of the reasons why we don't talk about whiteness is that whiteness is one of the few spaces where people feel that they can't acknowledge whiteness because it's inherently related to bad things. You know, everyone else celebrating their sort of their-ness is a good thing. But when you put whiteness on sort of trial, it doesn't stand up very well. So what you're asking people to do is to acknowledge that fact that I just read out aloud. Who wants that fact as a
sure.
part of their legacy?
Right, right.
So you have to recognize that when I spill truth to you, there are people. The far right is going to obviously have a reaction, but guess what? The left is too, but they just don't know what to do with that feeling.
That's a very good point. I think that's right.
I have nothing to add to that.
But I mean, like, I'm taking Chris's.
That was really well said.
You know, I'm taking Chris's offering, which is your offering is always let's go where people are. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that Pat Buchanan piece painted where I think a lot of the far right are, and maybe some moderates are.
So now I'm thinking about the Buchanan piece in a different way. He's going to reach out to middle and middle right people and be like, hey,
yes,
these are things you're white, you're dying. You know, I that's interesting. Mm-hmm. That's interesting. And, you know, I think it's deplorable.
And when you go... And when you go in the private booth and you want to vote,
you'll keep that in mind.
You would never have admitted.
Who wants to keep me? Maybe the reason why we're dying is because you're right. There aren't enough white men on TV. Maybe Trump will do something about that.
Or it's not so much about there aren't enough white men on TV. It's like my loss of stature. That's the crux
that's
of the piece.
Well, that's what he's saying. It's like in the loss of stature of straight white men. That's what's killing us. The only way to get it back is to seize the White House, to seize all popular culture, and by extension, you know, let's return everything to the 50s in that way.
Well, and
which is why Bernie is winning a general election versus Trump, because again, we still haven't really conceded to the sexism that's a part of that discussion as well, which is to return white men to a position of prominence also means that white women necessarily have to drop.
Well,
which might be why Trump loses. It might be the only reason Trump loses. You know,
yes.
I think we're touching on
it's
something.
The woman vote, that's going to be key.
Yeah. You know, the whole problem with the concept of whiteness is that it was constructed for the purposes of domination, and not just domination of people of color,
yep,
although certainly that has been the most oppressive domination, but also the domination of working class white people. So, but in this country, a lot of white people don't identify with anything other than being white and American. And as we're talking about, the problem with that is fraught with problems of colonialism and oppression. And so I almost think there's like an opportunity / need for us to construct an identity to be constructed that is inclusive, American inclusively and positive. Like what you hear Pat Buchanan saying is like, we got to get back to, you know, reclaim the stature that whiteness once had. That's never going to work. I mean, we're going to have fits and starts with that, but there is no escaping the fact that whiteness, that construct, has led to, you know, just enormous devastation of people and environment and et cetera. You know, instead of saying, like, let me keep my Confederate flag up because it's all I got, it's like, well, why can't we get something new that people can embrace and organize around and that's not distinctly white but is inclusive of working class white people?
Hmm.
Like, you mean like America should be, but isn't?
Right. Yeah. Okay. I guess so. Yeah.
So
yes. How do we construct that? What's the answer to all of our problems?
Well, because also remember, and I have to stick this in here, because there's been a really interesting series of conversations that I think a group of writers wrote a letter in protest to Donald Trump. Right? And what was really fascinating about this is that they were sort of liberal writers challenging Donald Trump, but someone else wrote a response to that letter, reason being, because even in the liberal letter, they painted America as this kind of noble experiment. So in some ways, so what I'm saying is that even liberals bought into the idea of a bygone good America. Do you see? And so that's why I think this idea of going back can resonate with many people, because there is still a liberal bias of American exceptionalism.
Well, by the way, you're totally right, and I think even Bernie references it at times.
Yeah.
But that's not exclusively white, though. I mean, there are
no. I'm saying I said liberals.
Yeah.
I said liberals. Yeah. Because that's what I mean.
No, you're absolutely right.
All right.
Which is weird. Wait, there are black leaders that calls to some sort of bygone era? Where are they and why are they crazy?
Well, I think it's tactical. I mean, I think that there's a motif among African American intellectual and political leaders, not necessarily again of a bygone era, but of bygone ideas, right? Like Martin Luther King used to reference like the Declaration of Independence, and I'm not being critical of that, but he did, and he would say like, no, look, what America, you know, Frederick Douglass did this. What America said it was about is good. We just need to live up to it. Obama's done that to some extent, and again, I don't know whether that is good or bad, but there's tendency in liberal thought to say like, well, no, the roots of all this are great. We just gotta live up to them.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think you're right. I think that's that is exactly how MLK worked too. He forced America to live up to its own promise, or he asked them to live up to the promises that they wrote down on paper, but was never really willing to do for everybody else.
Right.
So it's like you have a guiding document that you basically said fuck you to the whole time.
Okay.
See, we unpacked that Pat Buchanan in peace more than you thought we could.
Yeah, it was really. Yes.
Which brings me to our final and arguably most entertaining topic, mine.
You're welcome.
I don't know if that's the case.
This is a stealth topic. I'm springing it on the both of you. We didn't. Usually we have lengthy production meetings where we talk about what we're going to talk about. I'm kidding. No, we don't.
Yeah, but, especially not your topics, because you always spring them on us when you're doing it.
Yeah. So, yeah, you guys are so good sending them out, late last night? But anyway, I wanted to talk about sex. That's right, everybody. Sex. I had stumbled across an article that someone wrote on the internet, Love Life of an Asian Guy. If you don't follow him on Facebook, you absolutely must. He writes a lot about race and culture, and it's really good stuff, usually. He wrote an article that was critical of porn and the porn industry, which I thought was fascinating. Full disclosure, I think porn is fascinating. I think it's fascinating because we have such a troubled relationship with sex in this country that the number one selling thing in America, somehow we can't talk about it, or it's gauche to talk about it in public, about either watching porn or being in porn or owning porn, when everyone does at least two of those three things. In any case, he brought up the same problems with porn that I often find are problematic. Now, we can go far afield about all the problems with porn, from the way that women are depicted, to racist stereotypes, to the poor production values. But what I really wanted to talk about was the way...
Let's just have a quality critique of porn. We don't... All the other implications are fine, but what low quality?
Yeah,
this is unacceptable
saying,
in
like,
society.
I want to know, how are these pizza boys always ready to go? You know what I mean? Like, just out the gate, not wearing any underwear? No. What I wanted to say was, I feel that porn has really instructive power in our society, and that's what I find alarming. It used to be that porn was something you had to go into a store and buy, and in some ways it was rarefied. It was passed down from older sibling to younger sibling, from friend to friend, from friend, from whoever to whoever. It was a physical thing that you had to pop into your video player like late at night in the den after your parents and brother had gone to bed. I'm sorry, is this too personal?
I was going to say, not that you have any personal experience.
There's like a lot of like storylines about that.
My story is oddly very specific.
Yes.
But back in the day when it was a little more rarefied, I wouldn't make the argument I'm about to make. Now that porn is available on any of the multiple devices that anybody of any age has within 6 or 7 feet of them at any time, it gives me great pause to think about what we are doing with porn and why we're not turning our attention to it. I find that a lot of young people, their first experience with sex is by watching some sort of porn. Extraordinarily problematic, bringing in all the other problems that I mentioned before. What I've been focused on lately is just really how this applies to women. Yes, the gender stereotypes, but also just the misinformation and wrongness of how women's bodies are portrayed and what excites women and how their bodies work in porn. A lot of men learn about women's bodies through watching some sort of porn. Sadly, a lot of women learn about women's bodies through watching porn. So I don't have a question per se. I just want to throw you guys out to it, like throw this out to you guys. How do you see porn fitting into society? where exactly is the problem when we talk about pornography for you?
Well, have at it, Jason. Were you about to talk?
No, I mean, I think you should go first.
See, and even here, we can't. No one wants to talk about porn or sex.
No, I don't mind talking about porn at all. It's just that I'm not a frequent watcher of porn. I mean, I may read porn, I guess, but watching porn is different than reading porn, isn't it?
Maybe not, because even reading porn, I've read some of like the slash fiction and some of the porn that you've read, and even in that, there's a lot of. I mean, forget about the bodice ripping, which I find problematic, but the relationships between the people in those stories, and even the way the sex goes down, right? It's always hurried and fevered, and people are shoving it in places, and I happen to know bodies don't work that way, and if you think that they do, you're going to be sore. Anyway, you were saying.
However, I mean, I think my problem with porn is my problem with anything that is constructed, right? I mean, it's a construction. It's edited. It's put together in a certain way. This is not happening live action. So anyone that is going to take a construction, a media construction, seriously as an educational tool, as something that's going to inform them, is automatically going to be off, right? Because 100%. The same thing could be said. Yeah, the same thing could be said for a romantic movie. A romance movie. If you're looking at a romance movie and you think to yourself, this is exactly how romances should go, you already know that's fucked up. The problem with porn, though, is that people don't actually enter porn thinking that. Why is there no distinction between, like, hey, this is a porn, so this is obviously false and fake and crafted? Whereas because if you watch a romantic movie, you'd go, oh, well, clearly that's made up.
This is why. There's no counterpoint. So when I watch a romantic movie, and it's like The Notebook, and everyone's crying and raining. I don't know what that movie's about.
Yeah.
But I can look at that, and then I can look at my two friends who are, like, married and in love, and I can be like, oh, okay, I can reality test. If I'm 15 and I download some porn and I'm watching it, it's not like I can wander into, like, my older sibling's room and watch them have sex and be like, oh, okay, and then reality test. It's the only
Can I just say...
Well, that may be a solution.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Chris, even while you were just framing this, I was thinking maybe someone needs to... Like, maybe we need to have, you know, real couples agree to have, you know, cameras in their rooms and then just put them there and leave them there for 2 months. And then we take footage off of them and post that, not, you know, as, like, counter porn. You know, it's like, here's how sex really looks.
I mean, because or the
children,
or the most obvious caveat, we'll have sex education. We have real sex education. See, this is the problem, right? Because that's the counter. The counter is that we do not have legitimate sex education.
Well, let's talk about sex education, right? Because that so much goes underneath that umbrella. Let's talk about sex education, because on one hand, we have birth control in our bodies ourselves, right, and all of that.
Yep.
On the other hand, it's what I'm talking about, which is sort of sex. How does it happen? Almost everyone will have sex before they die. And almost everyone doesn't know how to do it. How is that possible in this day and age? So how can sex education help us there, Jason?
You have a lot of questions about education. We've never talked to you about sex education, Jason.
You spent the last month of topics on education, so...
Well, I agree that for the most part, the vast majority of kids do not have access to any substantive sex education. I mean, I don't know where to start with this question. I guess I'll just say two things. One is that I agree that there is a great opportunity to provide sex education and to teach kids about what sexuality really is and how to think about it and benefits and risks and all of those things. And the second point, which I think we all know, is that it's a very controversial thing. There are a lot of adults that think that, you know, school has a certain purpose and sex education is not one of them, and that should be taught by parents and not by anyone else. And obviously that becomes problematic because, A, you have some parents that what they teach their kids about sex is not healthy, and B, you have some kids who don't have access to parents who teach them about sex at all. So in theory, I think, yes, sex education should be a normalizing factor here. It's, you know, there are states that that don't do it at all by law. I think Mississippi is one of them. And then you have states that do it, but it's like very vanilla and not all that helpful. So I don't know what to do about that. Like everything else, there's a political obstruction to this being delivered well.
So I guess that means it serves somebody somewhere, right?
Well, I mean, we seem to be really resistant to all the elements of sex. We're resistant to it as a biological imperative. And then we're resistant to it as something that can happen within the context of a loving relationship. And then we're also resistant to sex as like a transactional thing. We just never...
on every level.
Yeah, we don't tackle any aspect of it. Like, it's one thing if people wanted to do the, like, glorified romantic love version. I'd be fine with that. But we just don't tackle it at all. It is like a dirty thing that gets reinforced by failing to talk about it within public education.
Because then it seems even dirtier and weirder. So before the broadcast, Trisha was telling about this horrific rape story. As she's telling me about it, I was struck by, like, how did this man think that any of the signals that he was receiving or not receiving were appropriate to move forward with sex against this girl's will? But, you know, when it comes to porn, as Trisha said, it's all construction. And the idea about women wanting sex or people getting ready for sex or the fact, as I joked earlier, that everyone is ready for sex at any moment in time, that's instruction. And we need a counterpoint like Jason said. Now, Jason, I don't know if filming real couples having sex and then distributing it to teenagers is going to be the way to do it, but I do think we need to have some sort of formal education about sex. I just don't know how we get over some of the political hurdles of that. We can't even get people to agree that people are having sex. We can't even get people to agree that teenagers want to have sex.
In lieu of kind of sex education, which, let's be honest, young people tend to reject any kind of offering of education in a school environment,
yep.
I would just lobby for more sexual interactions in many places now.
What?
Because you know why? Because in lieu of violence, why can't we have sex as the theme?
Violence, oh my God, I'm only
you know,
saying.
Violence is, you know what I mean? But violence is in video games. It's in practically anything that young people consume. But yet we don't have that same reaction with sex. Like, why can't we have just many points of view about sex being offered? Because
like,
I think
what,
that's
for the, example, give a couple examples.
For example, like, you know, what if you were to walk through a video game that posited different sexual scenarios to a young person and, you know, if done correctly, ooh, did you strike, if you stroke her here, she's actually orgasming. Or,
you gotta hit the G-spot.
I mean, like, and then, you know what I mean? And then you get points for it. And if you stroke her in the wrong way, you're losing points. Or I'm just saying, why haven't we offered sex as a space for creativity in communicating about it?
And you know what? I want to say that people listening will think that sounds insane, but when you think about, there's entire games, like entire themes of games, which revolve around the player having a gun and walking around and just shooting people in the head. Like,
I know!
For hours. So if you're listening to this and you're like, oh my God, a game where you're giving a woman an orgasm, which millions of men will actually be doing and women will actually have to do in their lifetimes versus
if they're skilled enough.
The very, 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 very few men who will have a gun and walk around and have to shoot people in the head. So if you're disturbed by the orgasm game, I'm going to ask you to check yourself because people are having orgasms. I'm not gunning down people in the street.
You know, or discovering the body. Like, what if you had a game where it was simply about discovering erogenous zones in the body? Recognizing that the body is like a fully alive thing where there are different regions of the body that can generate all sorts of feelings. So that's what I'm saying. It's like, I want it to be better talked about in romantic books, in young adult novels, in TV shows, in comedies. I mean, it's just, because even sort of like, I have to say, like, even like in these comedies, it's horrendous. It's almost as bad as how it's talked about in porn. It's presented in gross, over, like, exaggerated ways that are just, like, immature. So I just want sex to enter the landscape. Like, imagine if we were going to do, like, a sex podcast.
Or we just talk about sexual experience and which ones are good.
Sexual experience and which ones are good. Sexual signals. One day we do a podcast just entirely about sexual signals, like miscues, misreads, like, I mean, good ones, bad ones.
You know,
I mean, I just
think
it's just—it's not.
At least people would be talking.
Yeah, at least you'd. I mean, we've lost. Who's the modern Dr. Ruth? Remember, Dr. Ruth.
Chelsea Handler.
Chelsea Handler. Well, Laura Berman for a while. I don't know where she is now.
But think about how intricately intertwined Dr. Ruth was to the feminist movement.
The idea that she was demanding that women have good sex.
Yep.
In what world is that revolutionary? Like, that was new for women. What? Good sex? Well, why don't I have good sex? Don't mind if I do. Like, of course you should be having good sex.
But
or,
I think
or you know what? Remember a couple of years ago when the attorney, no, the head surgeon of the country, what's that person called? The Surgeon General had recommended that masturbation would be healthy.
People went nuts.
Single person was upset, and every person later that night went home and jerked themselves off.
That's so weird.
The irony of it was.
No, well, I think what you're touching on, though, Chris, this is I'm listening to you, Tricia, and everything you said makes sense rationally, and yet
no, but you can't.
People are so uncomfortable with their own sexuality that it's difficult to. I feel like when you open the door to open communication about sexuality, and I agree, that probably is the solution, but the obstacle is that that also opens the door to people confronting their own ambiguous feelings about their own sexuality, and people don't want to go there, unfortunately.
Okay. And I agree with you and understand that completely, but I'm not even going that far. I want to start with just communicating to kids. Kids, sex happens. I have sex. Like 90% of every adult you met over a certain age has had sex. People think about sex. People read about sex. Sex is, it's in the environment. Because when we pretend it's not here, I find that strange.
Yeah.
When I was much younger, and I used to be a manny for kids. And as the kids got older, they wanted to see R-rated movies. And they were like 13, 14, 15. And I was like, all right, I'll take you to see an R-rated movie. But if it's R-rated for sex, we're not going. If it's R-rated for violence, that's okay. I don't know why that made sense to me.
But that's the norm. That's the norm, I think.
I don't know why that made sense to me years and years and years ago. Now I'm always like, if it's R for sex, I would be fine with a 14 or 15 year old seeing that. Because you know what? I hope a 14 or 15 year old one day will have sex. But I do not hope that one day they will, like, black ops everyone and shoot a bunch of motherfuckers in the head. I do not want that for any child I've ever met. But I want every child I've ever met, when they get old enough to have sex. I don't know why we don't encourage that. Even the rating systems, if there is any nudity, even a flash of it, it's rated R. It's inappropriate for children. If there's a male penis involved anywhere that is erect or semi-erect, mm-hmm. it can't be shown in films. However, Saw had like 7 iterations. Human Centipede, they're on like Human Centipede 3. And these are like really gross, terrifying things. You know, American Sniper, all these movies about war, I don't know why that's more appropriate than just like...
Well, again, it's more appropriate because people don't have ambiguous feelings about their own violent tendencies, but they do about their sexual tendencies.
Can I ask you a question, Jason, personally?
Yes.
At what age, like, when are you going to talk to your kids about sex? Your kids are quite young, but I want to hear from a parent on this, because it's very easy for me to say, like, let's get a bunch of middle schoolers together and just, like, talk to them about sex and sex acts. That's easy for me because I don't have kids living with me and I don't have to deal with repercussions of that. What's your plan? Do you have one?
I don't have one yet, but my initial reaction to your question is 12-ish.
See, have you figured out how you're going to enter that conversation? Is it going to be about their bodies? Is it going to be about sex? I'm just curious what your plan is.
Yeah, well, it's a good question. So, again, I don't have a plan. I haven't thought through it a lot, but I think it would probably start with their bodies. And that would probably be the trigger for the conversation. I will say that my father spoke very openly with me about sex as a kid. And I felt like in that particular area, I had some pretty good guidance. You know, I feel the same way, that I would want to speak pretty openly with my... And this is a conversation that I think the kid's mom would be better to speak with my daughter about it. Not that I wouldn't to be taboo with me, but proactively... I think she may be better delivering the message about sexuality to my daughter, and I think I would want to proactively bring it up with my son. But I think I'd be pretty open about it, all of the great things about it, all of the risks about it.
Now I have a personal question for you, Trisha. Mm-hmm. What did your mom tell you about sex? Did you guys ever talk about it?
Never.
Not once. It never came up in any context ever.
No, I think not about sex. I think there was a conversation about my reproductive system. Because my mom's a nurse, so we had a pretty good conversation about my period and reproduction in general, but we've never had sort of like a sex talk.
What about you, Chris?
One time, my dad said to me once, if you have sex, wear a condom. That was the totality of that conversation.
Wow, I need to go thank my father. Like, he was pretty open about it.
Never about my body, about none of it. And which is astounding, because I grew up to be an adult who has sex against all odds. You know what I mean? against all odds. Can you imagine a world where after a certain age we stop talking to kids about bathrooms? Like,
I know.
What they're doing about, like pooping and pissing.
Yeah, you can't
talk. Can you imagine if we just... after potty training, we just never brought it up again? Like, what kind of weird shit would we get into as a nation? I don't know. Thanks for indulging me on that, guys.
Yeah, that was interesting. We got to a point where I don't know if it fell neatly in the categories you always say at the beginning, Chris, but that was a good conversation.
Well, it's about culture, you know, and it is about media.
That's
porn
true.
Porn is about a form of media, and media, as we know, is instructive. It carries a very powerful, normalizing message. And as always with porn, I have to raise an eyebrow, because when we normalize some of the things that you see in there, it's instantly problematic. So, speaking of porn, it's time for recommendations, which is a media event, something that you saw, heard, or experienced that you think other people should see, hear, or experience. Or if you're Jason, just any service provider, any roadside grocer, anyone you come across that you think is worthy of a shout out. So, Trisha, why don't we start with you, and then we'll cut out what Jason has to say next. Jason, I love you, but my God, you know what I mean?
I have a very normative one today.
I can't wait to. Trisha's
get
still
excited.
Going
I have a very normal one today.
Trish.
Trisha can't stop laughing.
All right. So so my sister and I were watching a show a couple nights ago, and we were sort of like surprisingly amused by it, because it's painting a picture of New York that I find vaguely familiar. It's called The Odd Parent, and it's on Bravo. And it's basically about this woman who... I've only seen like one or two episodes, but it seems quite hilarious. And
is it scripted, Trisha, or is it...
It's scripted, but they're comedians. Yeah, it's scripted TV. And it's essentially this characterization of New York and Brooklyn and Manhattan as these kind of enclaves of really just odd people. So the episode my sister and I actually ended up watching was this woman who was considering, she lived on the Upper East Side and she was considering moving to Brooklyn. So she went to this like Brooklyn party, which can I tell you is so Nouveau Brooklyn. So it's like these white parents and you know, the children didn't they didn't have grades. And so, and they were drinking drinks with placenta.
Oh, that's beautiful. That's great.
And at
that
one point, I know. And well, at one point,
reuse, recycle.
I know. At one point, the Upper East Side mom is her daughter turns to her and says, "Mom, how do you spell quinoa?" And the woman, when she begins to spell it out for her daughter, and the woman says, "No." The Brooklyn mom says, "No, stop." She's like, "Why?" She's like, "No, you have to let them sound it out."
Wait, if you actually did, you never arrive at the correct spelling of quinoa. Exactly.
I'm just going to admit, this is sounding a lot like my kid's school, which I love dearly, but it is sounding like that.
But then the punchline is, and I've been allowed to write like a welcome message on the board, on this like board for the guests, and none of the words are spelled correctly.
Yeah, no kidding.
But they kind of look phonetically okay.
Well, that's fine, because it's not important to get it right. How do letters make you feel?
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. And so there are like a series of things that the mom is just failing at. She tells the young daughter, the young guest daughter, "You're so pretty." "No, we don't mention looks."
We'll have to post a link to that. Sounds funny.
It was just an hilarious episode. It might have just been that episode that was so good, but I just thought it was just like a perfectly, it was like a really wonderful SNL skit, but just done right. So, and I just thought, it just reminded me of the education discussion. Like, I don't want grades for my children.
That's fun. Very fun. We'll have to, definitely we'll have to get the link for that, and we'll put it up on the Facebook page.
Yeah, it sounds good.
My recommendation... Yeah. Because it is 4th of July, I wanted to make a 4th of July branded recommendation. So Jason had mentioned Frederick Douglass earlier on in the podcast, and I'm reading through his speech that he gave on July 5th, 1852. It's called,
it's great.
It's known as What to the Slave is the 4th of July. And in it, he talks about the 4th of July as a celebration for white Americans, but it's a day of mourning for slaves and former slaves who are constantly reminded about the broken promise and the dream deferred of America. Whenever I read accounts from slaves and former slaves and just African Americans of the 19th century, 18th century, I'm always stunned, not by their education or the fact that they can put these words together, but the fact the bravery they have to say this. I can only imagine. Yeah. He gave this speech to abolitionists, so maybe they were friendly fire in a certain sense, but the bravery of him to stand up in front of a bunch, probably a mostly white crowd, and say these things, I can't imagine. Because as woke as the people might have been at the time, they certainly were of a certain time, and I'm always in awe of that.
I agree. That speech is amazing and so courageous. And, I don't know if you remember, but when we had the Oscars So White conversation where we were analyzing Chris Rock's performance, I thought that, like, that speech should have been his template. I mean, obviously, more comedic version, but the way that it was acknowledging the celebration but then undermining it or subverting it, I felt like that would have been the more effective approach for Chris Rock to take at the Oscars. Not that, I think it's a great speech, and I'm glad you bring it up.
So that leaves us with Jason's recommendation. So, all right, everyone, this is about to happen to us, so let's just get it over with. Jason?
Right. Now, this is going to be a very normative one, and I want you to feel free to let me know if you find this so boring that you hope in the future I go back to talking about local service providers.
Okay.
For a long time, people had been saying, and I've been reading, like, you got to watch Veep. And I watched 10 minutes of the first episode a long time ago, and I just wasn't feeling it, so I never watched it again. And yesterday, for whatever reason, I decided to try it again. And I watched the whole first episode, and then I watched 5 episodes from the first season in a row and really just found it fantastic. So I'm now a Veep fan. This is what I do. It was the same thing, if you recall, with Curb Your Enthusiasm, where, Chris, you had left me a DVD to watch it. I watched a couple episodes, I didn't like it. I didn't watch it for years, and now I've binge-watched all of it. So I'm now doing that with Veep, and I think it's great.
I love Veep. The current season, not so much. The showrunner
left. Love that show.
The showrunner left. And so
I have a long way to go before I get to the...
It's taken a bit of a turn, and they even admit that, the show is called Veep, but it's no longer about a vice president anymore.
Well, right. I'll enjoy the however many seasons I have to watch before I'm in that predicament.
And good job on your recommendation, by the way. We need to give you as much positive feedback as possible.
It took all my restraint not to talk about the barbershop where my son gets his haircut.
And you just did. So, hey, everybody. Have a fantastic 4th of July. And
M1 Innovations.
Okay, all right. 4th of July, everybody. Bye, guys.
Bye.
Bye.